Four students from Lafayette. So, but I guess we gotta get started here. Okay. What?
Okay, ready everyone. To start.
Okay, we're gonna start. One, two, three, go.
All right. You have to turn the Skyper so they're looking at me.
Looking at the guy over there.
All right. All right. We'll begin by...
We have our prayer there. We start with the four lines on the top of the blackboard there. I go for refuge and to enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of listening to the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge and to enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of listening to the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge and till enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of listening to the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming and for coming back. And I get a lot of benefit from... studying in this form. I mean, teaching is a kind of studying, and as we talked about yesterday, studying is a kind of practice. And I found over the years that talking about these things and having to talk about them more and answer questions that I have gotten to understand them better over time in doing that. So that's codependently arisen with you. I have a few questions left over from yesterday I'm going to start with. And then I'm going to give a quick synopsis of what I thought was important out of yesterday. And then as we go along today, I'm going to try to go over chapters 5, 6, 7, and maybe some part of 9. In the course of today, and probably skip 8 because, and maybe probably not do very much with 10. Okay, so one of the questions from yesterday was, I was saying, well, why did Buddha call it emptiness rather than fullness? And somebody said, maybe because fullness implies a concept of something being filled and therefore is in some way limited. That's a possible way to think about it. My reaction to it was that, well, you know, you have something being filled and something that's filling up, and so there's an interdependence between those two, but that's also true in the case of emptiness. You have emptiness isn't just, as we were saying yesterday, something we'll talk about more today, isn't something that's just self-existence. It's there's emptiness and that which is empty of that exists interdependently also. So you don't necessarily get out of the concept of some sort of kind of relationship or interdependence. I think, and this is what I was doing yesterday when I was talking about like pulling your hair the wrong way, is that I think the emptiness is intentionally the way that everybody, almost everybody, talks about ultimate reality in Buddhism, because it appropriately goes against the grain of this deepest innate source of our problem, which is this tendency to exaggerate how things exist. And many people feel like, oh, it would just be so nicer if we could talk about dependent arising, or we could say, well, we could just accept that things exist conventionally without having to talk about emptiness. I've heard it that way as well. The problem with that is when you just try to talk about how, say, kind of an ecological approach is like everything's connected, or you just try to talk about, yeah, well, things exist conventionally, you can't actually like get to a correct understanding, at least from Tsongkhapa's point of view, of what that is, unless you go through the route of thoroughly negating all of the extra that's added on. For example, if you try to understand what it means for things to be all connected to each other and therefore full of each other and making the world rich and teeming with energy, and you try to do that without refuting the exaggerated sense of how each of these things exist, then you have a kind of like all of these things, although interrelated, are able to be interrelated because each has some independent reality of its own on the basis of which it can hook up with other things. I don't know if you follow me, but that's like the way we think about relationships. It's like, yeah, I'm in a relationship. It's like if I, you know, and if I, I'm in a lot of relationships, and I can have these relationships because I'm real in the first place, in and of myself, from my own side. It's not like, it's like, well, first I was who I was, and then I decided whether or not to pick him up at the train station. it's not like, you know, so we think first we're real in and of ourselves objectively from our own side, and then we have or don't have different kinds of relationships on that basis. And it's like, that is the problem of just sort of saying, well, let's just talk about conventional existence and not talk about emptiness. Let's just talk about dependent arising and not talk about emptiness. Is you don't directly get at that element of exaggeration, and you have a kind of, you have, you know, a nicer kind of appreciation of how things might be connected, but you still have this exaggerated sense that that's only possible because you're grasping on to each of those things. Okay, anyway, that's my answer to that. Question two, when emptiness is realized and the self is dropped, what is the intelligence that's doing that realizing? And the person says, must be something like some sheer interconnected awareness or pure formless intelligence. Yeah, well, so there's lots of different, there's different ways to realize emptiness and talk about, there's different kinds of minds that know emptiness, put it that way. What we've been talking about mostly is the importance of using analysis and reason to try to, understand what emptiness means, first of all, then figure out in meditation, which is still analytical and conceptual, how it might apply or relate to us particularly, and then eventually develop some sort of conceptual analytic certainty that, oh, these things really don't exist in the way that they appear to me, in the way that I, you know, feel that they do, but it must be a wrong feeling because it's not really like that. And those are powerful conceptual understandings of emptiness. And it's the basis for further practice. It's like, you know, it's not just an intellectual comprehension of it. It's like something that goes way beyond that to a deep personal certainty. But it's still conceptually mediated, you could say. It's a kind of certainty that you have in your mind that's based on reasoning. That then is the basis for further meditation, in which you take that emptiness as a concept that you've painstakingly discovered, you know, as the opposite of your delusion, and you take that emptiness as a concept as the basis for stabilizing meditation. That is like setting your mind one-pointedly at rest in a very clear, concentrated way. And it's very difficult to stabilize your mind. It's difficult to stabilize your mind on anything, right? But it's particularly difficult, and it's an even higher level of difficulty to say, let's take this very complicated idea that we reach at the end of a long process of analysis and then take that idea and stabilize our minds one-pointedly on it. Because the force of our certainty that things are empty rises only at the end of like a process of analysis. It's like if whatever the highest type of math, suppose you do calculus and you do the hardest calculus problem you can do, and you come to like the certainty that this is the answer, then like try to stabilize your mind on that certainty. And what happens is, of course, because you haven't, after a while, is because you haven't recently gone through all the steps which assure you and certify that this is the answer, your sense of certainty about this and the clarity of your knowledge of the answer begins to fade away, because your mind's not analyzing anymore. It's just setting one-pointedly on that answer. So then you have to go back and analyze again. Of course, it gets easier, you know, once you've already done it, but refresh your analysis, like check your work of the calculus problem, check your work of proving that you don't exist in and of yourself. Go through the reasoning again, reestablish a sense of certainty, and then stabilize your mind again. And you go back and forth like that between analytical meditation and stabilizing meditation. And eventually you get to a point where you can stabilize your mind with a kind of lucid, vivid, one-pointed clarity, a very, very powerful, sharp mind that's one-pointedly focused on this conceptual but very clear, certain understanding that everything is devoid of intrinsic nature. And that's still not nirvana. Then, once you get to that point where you can stabilize your mind one-pointedly on this idea of emptiness, you find that over a period of time, it's like through the power of concentration, your mind is like penetrating the object. You're coming to get to the point where, in a sense, you can know the object directly with your mind. It's like any kind of concentration or high meditative stabilization can be used as the basis for developing, when you say, supernormal powers, not supernatural powers, but extraordinary capacity to do things, right? So if we pay really close attention, we can see things and notice things and be attuned to things and penetrate to things that are not necessarily visible, obviously, on the surface, right? So like that, when you have this, it is that case of that, when your mind has this powerful serenity, is the book we the word the term that we use in the Great Treatise. When you have a serenity, it's a very powerful consciousness that's focused on emptiness. It penetrates eventually, gradually, through the conceptual mediation of emptiness and knows emptiness directly, just like, you know, with the direct force of sense perception, in a sense, but in a little bit different, as we'll describe in a second. In other words, it appears vividly and nakedly to your mind without the mediation of this conceptual image. And that's the point that this person is referring to, where you're actually having direct, and that was the word we were using last night, was confusing somebody, direct, that is unmediated by conceptual image, non-dualistic, that means that there's no aspect of the subject that's appearing to the mind, you know, that I'm realizing emptiness and emptiness is the thing I'm realizing. That so it's non-dualistic in that sense. Direct, non-dualistic knowledge of emptiness is not like other knowledge because there's no sense of like you knowing it and it's apart from you. And also what you're knowing is the ultimate nature of the mind itself that's doing the knowing. You know, so it's like everything is completely open, like space, and there isn't any. So when you think about like what is that mind like, it's like we can tell stories, you know, but they're based on, you know, trying to see. We can tell different kinds of stories. Like we can tell stories. Well, what does it look like when we stand over here and try to describe in dualistic conceptual terms what a yogi experiences in direct non-conceptual non-dualistic experience, right? That's what we usually do in Gelugpa. I mean, that's what we do. What can we say that's reasonable about this in language, which will, of course, be dualistic, right? But now what we're talking about is something that has an experience that has the exact character of being most difficult for that kind of thing. So another thing is you could write a poem about it, or, you know, you could give some sort of evocative metaphor that tries to, like, capture, you know, what this is like in a way that's not intended to be philosophically literal, but is more arises out of someone, you know, trying to evoke rather than create a philosophy, right? And then, you know, you get things like, you know, pouring clear water into clear water, or other people, you know, have different ways of talking about this kind of stainless wisdom that isn't really wisdom, because when we think of wisdom, we think of it as like a mind knowing an object. Now, when we stand over here, we say, yeah, there's the yogi, and the yogi's realizing emptiness, so there is a mind realizing an object. That's true, but from the point of view of the yogi, it's not like that. until the yogi comes out and says, oh, I was realizing emptiness, you know, but when they're realizing it, it's nothing like that at all. That's the point. Okay. But the point is that, like, when we're talking about trying to understand emptiness, we're like a few stages back, to say the least, you know, from nirvana, which is that, you know, that experience. It's like yeshe means, you know, you're having a there's a primordial, it is purity to the mind, because it's always been pure of any kind of essentially existent afflictions. And now that's mixed with a new kind of purity, which is the purity that arises from the practice of the path of permanently eradicating some portion of those afflictions. You know, so it's like you've always had a a beautiful, you know, marble or stainless steel countertop that was in and itself unmarred and perfect, but you know, somebody spilled a bunch of goop over it and nobody'd ever clean it up. And now you've taken 1/9 of it and polished it up really good. So the kind of, you know, purity that was already there has been mixed with the happen to have happened purity of you cleaning up that part of it. And so then that's the mind shines in that way. Okay, question 3. Somebody said, is the lack of self seems to be shown by the dependence of things on parts. Are parts infinitely analyzable so that there is no irreducible element? And we talked about this a little bit. I think it was at dinner yesterday for some of us. And basically the short answer is yes. That's the idea. That's one of the ideas, is that we talked about that, you know, the self, there's some people who think, you know, well, the self, we're empty of the kind of self that we believe in, because when we watch very closely, we can't find anything like that. And what we do find, though, is these elemental experience or tiny bits of matter or tiny bits of experience. And so the self is something that's been superimposed as though it were a substantial, unified, permanent block upon something that, which doesn't exist, but it's been superimposed upon this complex of flowing bits, and each one of these bits is like an irreducible element. And then other, you know, Mahayana philosophers came along and said, well, it may be that when you meditate, that this little bit, you know, a point instant of pressure and the ball of your foot as you're taking a step is the smallest thing that you can notice at that moment, no matter how refined your concentration is. But does that tiny little elemental experience take up any time or not take up any time? If it doesn't take up any time, then no matter how many of them you have, you'll never actually finish taking a step, you know, because that's like one part of the experience of taking the step. But if it does take up even the smallest, say it takes up 1/1,000,000,000 of a second, I don't even think, you can't see that small, but suppose it does, 1/1,000,000,000 of a second, then it's like, well, there's the beginning of that 1/1,000,000,000 of a second and the middle of that 1/1,000,000,000 of a second and the end of the 1/1,000,000,000 of a second and so forth. And so even though we can't actually observe these, we can easily understand that if there's any extension, that there's like, you know, the in time, that there's a beginning and an end. And then there's, and likewise with the material bits that, you know, we think of as being like, you know, the basis of, part of the basis of imputation for the table and so forth, that like there's little tiny splinters, and then there's like, we think of molecules and then atoms and then like quarks or something, and then maybe strings, and it's like, well, it's like Newsweek announces, physicists discover the thing inside of strings. Or called ding-a-lings or donuts. You know, who knows what they're called? It doesn't matter. Do they, from the Buddhist, traditional Buddhist philosophy, we just say, well, do they take up any space or not? You know, it's like, oh, they're half-dimensional or one, you know, who knows what they'll say? One-dimensional. The strings are already one-dimensional, right? So if they, you know, if they extend from, they're only one-dimensional. So, you know, it's like, yeah, but do they extend from here to here? Then there's like the east side of it and the west side of it, or if it's going that way, you know, it's like, so if they're extending in some kind of space, then in some kind of dimensional space, who cares if it's the 9th or the 3rd, in some kind of dimensional space, there's the part that's over there and the part that's over here, mm-hmm. right? And so what do you call those parts? You know, well, we don't know yet. We can't talk about that. We don't have the formula. But, you know, it's like that's the problem. It's like, so as a result, this kind of Buddhist philosophy assumes that, like, you know, anything that, like, we think of as taking up space or time is that you can't posit some things, you can't say, well, let's get to the reality of it getting to some irreducible building block. It's okay. Okay. Oh, and I wanted to come back to one aspect of Nancy's question from yesterday, which I didn't think I really hit. And part of her question dealt with the idea that emptiness helps us or helps bodhisattvas as they try to help other people, it helps with the strain of caring for many other people. That it's very difficult, you know, that one gets compassion fatigue or burnout. And it's like, how does the bodhisattva tolerate the pain of so many? And in Buddhist practice, the idea of meditation on emptiness is one way that the bodhisattva increases her capacity to bear the suffering of infinite numbers of beings. It says, in order to help all living beings, in our opening thing, all living beings. What are we going to do for all the cockroaches of Turkey, you know? And like, I'm sure they have a very difficult, and so forth. It's not just all the people, which is already I heard Jeffrey was talking recently at another place, and he was saying, well, forget about all living beings. Let's just see if we could care about a few that are around here. Oh, no. I like all. It's much easier to think about. Yeah. So, in other words, when you start getting down to specifics and, actually taking care of people, and then there's more and more and more and more and more and more, and it's not just the people. Then you've got all the animals and so forth, you know, and they're suffering so much. And then, how do you bear this? And meditating on emptiness and having that working together with compassion has been a way that is understood makes it possible for the bodhisattva to expand the capacity to include limitless beings. So then part of her question was, so why would His Holiness then discourage people from converting to Buddhism, since this is the way that you expand your capacity to care in that way? And I gave a substantial answer yesterday, but I think the one thing I left out that I kind of wanted to say was that I think it's probably pretty clear that, and although His Holiness did not say this at Lehi, so I'm saying my own, I said what he said yesterday. But I think that part, to fully answer her question, I have to say that I think other religions have other ways to do this. I think it's self-evident, in fact. For example, if you look at the history of what Christians have done, not the bad things they've done, but let's look at the kind of self-sacrifice and dedication to social welfare that's been part of the history of Christianity, is part of what Christians do today. It's like they have built into their scriptures and to their doctrines other things which have nothing to do with emptiness whatsoever, but which give them resources to draw on to tolerate, you know, vast amounts of suffering. And if you posit a living example, you have, you know, Mother Teresa. And it's like, she's not going around, oh gosh, another sick person, another dying person. It's like, she said very clearly, oh, I see all these people as Jesus. It is like, I see Christ in each one of these people. And it's like, okay, this is directly comes out of the Gospels. She's doing a practice where she's not being taxed by yet another person who's in poor and dying, but she sees this all as a form of her devotion to God, right? And so do you see what I'm saying? It's like, just like you could say, well, for Buddhists, it has to do with emptiness, and that's the ultimate. Well, for them, you know, this ultimate is, you know, Yeshu, you know, Jesus, and their relationship to Jesus and their devotion to Jesus becomes the basis for them being able to do this. I think it's very clear. And His Holiness talked about that when he got into his how does a theist feel moment. He was saying, you know, well, people, it's like if you believe in God, it's like God is your parent and you love your parent and you're devoted to your parent and your parent cares for you and you feel a sense of love. And it's like, if you feel this in relationship to God, then you want to do, you know, it gives you a feeling of wanting to do what God wants you to do. What does God want, you know, because you feel so much love from God. And he's like, well, you know, if God wants me to go out and take care of the poor, then this will make me happy, independently whether the poor are grateful or not. You know, even if they're you know, they're very angry and don't like me trying to help them, it doesn't even have to do with them. It has to do with something between me and Jesus, right? Okay. So that gives them forbearance, right, in the face of obstacles. Okay. All right. Now, that's my question. So what did we do yesterday? Quick summary. I started out by arguing that the basic purpose or aim, which we set out at the beginning, was to try to seek to help, to seek to ease the pain, to ease the the existential pain as well as the physical and mental pain of all living beings. And to do that, that we aspire to become perfect embodiments of wisdom and compassion. And so that's the result that we're aiming at. And in order to get that, we have, how can we have this capacity? How can we get to being beings who have that kind of capacity to help? We have to cultivate or systematically train in, and that's the path, skills in wisdom and analysis in terms of both kinds of ways of thinking about how things exist. That is both the rabbit and the duck, both channel A and channel B. We have to be skilled at like switching over from channel A, where we're hearing all the arguments about different things, to channel B, where everything dissolves into emptiness. And we have to then be not just like stay on that emptiness channel and say, oh, this is so peaceful, I'm just going to stay here forever, because then we'll be in arhat and we won't be helping people. We have to go back over to channel A, where conventional realities appear, and say, okay, you know, given that all these things are empty, I still have to think what will be most helpful, to promote this kind of educational policy in Bhutan, or that one, or this kind of prison reform policy in Massachusetts, or that one, you know. And it's like, you have these choices make a difference in the world in terms of whether you're actually doing anything to help living beings, right? So you have these two kinds of skill in wisdom or skill in analysis. One is like skill in looking at things and how they work and what makes a difference conventionally. And one is getting at the ultimate nature of things and seeing that the very root of all needless misery is this delusion that's at the root is unfounded, because the ultimate nature of things is completely empty. So you have these two kinds of things, two kinds of wisdoms. One is getting at conventional, and one is getting at the ultimate. And that's the basis from which you're working. Okay? So then, in regard to that, I tried to make, I think, three key points yesterday. One is that for Tsongkhapa, not thinking is not enough. You have to use even though Buddha has no thinking whatsoever, that we have thinking, and it's not like we just have to stop thinking to become Buddhas, but rather, we have to use what we have now to try to understand emptiness and to try to make conventional distinctions. And eventually, then, we can phase out the thinking. We can get past the thinking phase in the way I described earlier by using concentration meditation. But for now, we have to use thinking to try to understand what emptiness is. Otherwise, we can just like zone out. But when we come back, we won't have understood anything that will be the antidote or directly opposite to and rooting out the misconception or delusion that's the root of our suffering. So you have to understand something. You have to first intellectually understand it, and then you have to understand it internalize it, or it was like in an introspective way. You have to see how it applies to my solar plexus and so forth. Well, what is it like in my guts? And you have to see how it is from the inside. And then when you understand it in that way, then on that basis, you can work to the non-dualistic understanding. Not just try to say, let's be non-conceptual right now. Second point was that analysis that is not ultimate, which I just described, is the keystone of one of the keystones of Tsongkhapa's innovations. It's not just like, some people say this, like there's not a non-analytical perspective and analytical perspective. If you have a non-analytical perspective, you just go along with the fictions that the world believes in. And if you have an analytical perspective, you see that everything's empty and you're above all that. Okay? Yeah, but how do you know at the conventional level what kinds of things would be more helpful, A, in getting you to realize the ultimate, and B, doing some things to help people in the meantime? Well, you can't, because A, from the ultimate point of view of analysis, everything's empty. And from the conventional point of view, this is all a fiction and you kind of go along with the conventions of the world. And Tsongkhapa is saying, no. There has to be analysis of, you know, what works and what doesn't work within the conventional level. What is what? Making distinctions, asking questions, and looking for evidence and making arguments and proving things to yourself, which are other than emptiness, that are like, what would be a better way to go from here to there? What would be, you know, a better kind of medicine and so forth, okay? And third, that ultimate analysis, when we do this ultimate analysis, when we really, you know, meditate on how things don't arise from themselves, other, both, or neither, or we do, or realize that the person doesn't exist as one with or other than its basis of imputations, or we do some other kind of meditation on emptiness, and we get to the end and we like can't find anything. That doesn't prove that the thing that we were scrutinizing doesn't exist. As I was saying, it proves that it can exist in such a way as to be found under that kind of analysis, as I said yesterday. And that means it's like, well, of course, if you look with a microscope, you won't be able to tell what, you know, very easily. You would take a long time to figure out that this was a pen. And if we wanted to use a microscope, it would be hard to learn a lot about astronomy and so forth. It's like when you in that analogy, right, that ultimate analysis is like the microscope. So you learn some kinds of things with it, and the fact that you don't see other things doesn't negate or refute those things existing. Just means that they don't exist under that kind of type of scrutiny. Okay, so then today, let's start with the idea of the rabbit duck that I showed you yesterday. You know, you have this image that's like, if you look at it one way, it's a rabbit. You look at it the exact same lines, it's a duck. It's like, really looks just equally good either way, right? So we're saying this is like the conventional and ultimate way of looking at things. It's an example of that, right? And that seeing it in one way doesn't cancel out its being the other way. So the fact that we can see it perfectly clear as like that every part of it is a part of a rabbit's head doesn't mean that it's not also a good depiction of a duck. Okay, in that way, through and through, every bit of this that we can point to is completely empty. But that does not... That's being true on channel B, that being true from the point of view of ultimate analysis, doesn't at all cancel out that we can have reliable conventional knowledge about what that duck looks like. You say, we could discuss the duck in detail without ever mentioning the rabbit, even though the whole time, from the front to the back, it was also completely a rabbit from another point of view, right? So what does that mean? That example is intending to show that we have conventional, reliable minds, or conventional, valid cognizers, that there's kinds of, in the new philosophical way of saying, we have epistemic instruments. We have ways of knowing things and making the sorting out what is what at the conventional level, right? So what is it that we're seeing with these reliable, conventional minds? We're seeing conventional truths or conventional realities. We're not seeing emptiness. That would be over, you know, that's the duck truth or channel B or whatever, right, on the other side. So conventional truth or conventional realities, things that exist are not the ultimate reality. So the etymology of this, that we were talking about briefly in the break yesterday, the usual word, gunsopdembra or samvritti satya, it means like, something like fool's gold or an idiot's truth or truth for a fool or Jeffrey's doing jerk truth or truth for a concealing ignorance. That is something that's taken to be true and real by delusion, right? And therefore is not really true and real. So, you know, it's like one way of saying, yeah, tell me about the two truths. That must be two kinds of truths. It's like, well, no, there are two kinds of things that exist, but one is called falsities, things that exist but completely appear other than how they are, and then the other ones are the ultimate, the actual truths or the real truths. You know, that's emptiness. Okay, so yeah, that's the thing. It's like you think two kinds of truth. What is the conventional truth? What's the truth of conventional truth? When you talk about it like that, the truth of conventional truth is a false truth. It's like, how much gold do you find in the fool's gold? It's like, well, yeah, but it still exists. It's just not gold. It's something else, right? Well, like that. It's like that, okay? So the fact that this is a jerk truth, you know, truth for a dummy, doesn't mean that it doesn't exist at all. It just means that it's being true to how it appears is only something a dummy would fall for, or more to the point, it's something that a dummy would make up. Because you know, you say something that dummies fall for, you're always putting the blame on the object. That's what I like to do. Oh, these forms are so deceptive. They keep fooling me. So, how do we have, so things do have, so even though they're jerk truths or fool's gold, nonetheless, they exist, and we need to know about them if we're going to be helpful to people. So what kind of information, what are these, what kind of reliable conventional information or sources of knowledge do we have about this, you know, fool's gold world? Well, in the first instance, we have reliable sense perception. That is, we can get if I'm not drunk and I'm not on hallucinogens and, you know, I don't have like some double vision in my eyes, then, you know, I can look at the sky and say that, you know, there's one moon, and I can give you a sense of what phase it's in. Do you know what I'm saying? It's like, and that's like, you know, and it's like that with everything else. You can say, well, which way is the road? We drove over here. We have to know which way the road was turning. And the fact that we didn't crash is suggestive of something, don't you think? I think it's suggestive of something. Maybe we actually had some reliable information there. You know, it's like, well, how do we get that? Everything's just an illusion. Well, things don't exist as they appear, but we're getting, even within that, we're even within the mist of all of that not existing as they appearness, we're getting some reliable information that allows us to not crash the car. Well, if you just extend that, you say, well, we have all kinds of reliable information. We know the difference between cats and hats and cows and horses. And, you know, if we work on it a little bit, we could actually tell the difference between a bull and a cow. And then eventually you can get up to like telling the difference between a male gerbil and a female gerbil. And so over there, it's like, and then you can, you know, so this piece of DNA from that piece of DNA. And it's like, all of these things, you know, just arise from like having the ability to like get reliable information out of these highly deceived senses, you know. So they're deceived in some way, but at the same time, they're giving us reliable information. This is like a huge point for Tsongkhapa. Other people don't say like this. It's very hard for them because they, it's like thinking, well, these are stupid, deluded, ignorance, tainted minds. How can we, you know, trust anything that they're saying at all, you know? So then you say, well, just see what the teacher has to say, and maybe he'll give me a meditation which will pole vault me from this place where everything I see is wrong to some other place where I'll see the light. Anyway, that's why I feel about it.
Could everybody make sure that they're on mute in the Skype world there, please?
But that's not the only kind of conventional useful knowledge. Reliable conventional information, reliable sources of information at the conventional level, it's not just our senses. It's also the fact that we can think and reason or analyze. Now we don't just like reason, like if I'm a mind in a box, I don't have anything to reason with. But we have all of this data that comes in for our senses. So we can know lots of stuff which we haven't directly perceived by reasoning on the basis of the stuff that we have perceived with unimpaired senses. Now, of course, if you've been fooled by your senses about something, you can reach the wrong conclusion. Or if you make a mistake in your logic and you overextend, you know, what from extrapolate from the data you have. I mean, there's all kinds of ways to mess up, right? But we have reliable information from our senses, and then we have the capacity to know with certainty other things which we haven't directly perceived by reasoning on the basis of that evidence, right? That's why. So what does it mean then for things, these things that we're knowing about or finding or getting information about, to be said to be conventionally existent? In the second volume, second revised edition, which is the one with the beech grass, or whatever it is. Do you call that decorative grass or something?
Yeah, it is like beech grass.
Beech grass. Beech grass on the cover. At the bottom of page 45, It, Tsongkhapa's Great Treatise lays out three criteria for saying that something exists conventionally. First, a conventional conscious knows about it. No other conventional cognition contradicts its being like that, and reason that accurately analyzes its final reality does not contradict it. Okay, so I want to like try to explain this from my way of talking about it. I see this as like the Tsongkhapa is saying, instead of saying conventional existence means that you have a certain kind of mind that can know stuff because it looks at stuff and sees some kind of like intrinsic character in the thing that certifies that that thing is what it is instead of the other thing. Like cats, hats, you know, it's like, well, there must be a catness to a cat that the correct cat-knowing mind goes out and checks on, see if the catness is in the cat, or if it isn't in there, then maybe that's a hat instead of a cat. You know what I'm saying? It's like you have to, like, you know, oh, does it have the Joshuosity to be properly established as and recognized as Joshua? Well, I'll have to go over and check. You know, it's like this is actually how people think. Most other people think that reliable cognition works, that it has to certify a character in the object. All right? And so it's like if you're going to say nothing has any intrinsic character, like, how can you say that there's reliable knowledge? What's it knowing? What is it? How does it know that that's not a hat? And you know what I'm saying? If it's not going to check the Joshua-ness of, then how would it know? Do you know what I'm saying? It is kind of, this sort of like seems like a problem. And so what Tsongkhapa is saying, well, look, we have all this stuff that is said to be so by the world. We have the conventional world map that we've received. Well, think of that as like a big pie. Here are all the categories into which the world has divided the flow of experience and has posited for us as existing, right? Think of that as like a big pie. And then, so that's the first criteria. There's something conventional conscious that knows about this. It's like the, okay? Then, some of these things, even though the world believes in them and talks about them and, you know, posits them in the big pie, get chopped off and taken away. So, for example, I just thought of this example this morning. The Emperor's New Clothes. This is a perfect example. It's like, you don't even have to think about it. You just have to look. You know, it's like, oh, the Emperor's New Clothes, right? So everybody's talking about it. That's something like, it meets the first criteria. Right? Conventional, everybody's talking about the Emperor's New Clothes, right? But, it, you know, it's like, oh, one person is saying, oh, yeah, but my eyes are telling me something different. I don't even have to, you know, it's because I'm not thinking about it in particular that I'm able to see that, like, that doesn't seem to be, you know, the way I'm experiencing things, right? So we have this, there's like a falsification of some things that are conventionally said to exist in the world by direct empirical experience. And so that piece of the pie then can be sort of falsified. It's like people say this, it's a conventionally said to be, but this boy doesn't have anything wrong with his eyes. He hasn't, you know, eaten any, hallucinogenic rye that's where the, you know, something like that, where the, you know, the mold grows on the rye and then it makes you hallucinate. He hasn't eaten anything like that. So, like, well, you know, he's qualified to say that the emperor is actually naked, right? Okay, that piece of the, so that kind of, there's a lot of things like that, you know, people say are true, but if you just look, it's not. There's many more things in the next category. It's like, well, it's not quite so evident that it's true, but it's possible to think about it and analyze on the basis of what's evident. And in that regard, it seems like there's always kinds of progress, you know, in terms of figuring out. Like a good example is flat Earth. Like for a long time, you could say that it was conventionally known. Like in the early 20th century, everybody in Tibet felt that they knew that the world was flat. They had actually a very much more detailed picture of the world of Jambuling. You know, this is like they had a cosmology, a very clear cosmology, and it was like roughly speaking flat, but it actually had some other dimensions to it too. And it's like, well, the problem with that is that even though everybody said that was like that, if you actually gathered empirical data, right, and then analyzed that data using conventional reasoning, you could conclude some very different picture of the model of the universe that would false was more useful, more accurate, fit better with our perceptions than the one that people were generally accepting as being the case. It's like you think about, like, people say, like, a path, what do they say? A road is made by walking. A path is made by walking. You know, if people are doing and saying things in a certain way, and it seems to be somewhat useful, then that gets to be established. It's like, okay, now we talk about certain categories. There's a category, like Dharma Center, that's a category. It didn't used to be a category, but now it's a thing. You know, it's a category. So category, think kinds of things get established by kinds of practices that people do, and then people think of those as real things that are there. But they come out of the kinds of interactions that have been successful and useful in the past and create this kind of map of the world. But these maps can be, you know, falsified, is what I'm saying, by further evidence and testing and replaced with new maps that, like, seem to work better, right? So we can, like, lop off another, the flat earth section, in saying, well, we can't actually look and see that, the earth is sort of spheroid. But if we look at things that we can look at and then think about what that must imply, you know, at some point we can get to an understanding, you know, that those other ways of thinking about it are discredited. And then finally, there's things that people have believed for a long time and strongly hold on to as being conventionally the case, and which it's hard to, like, just use ordinary analysis to discredit. Like the idea that there's a divine creator, or the idea that we have an essentially existing, permanent, real, graspable soul or something that's the pith and core of our being. And people, like, hold on to these ideas, but you have to, like, analyze the basic, you have to ask the question, like, how do things really exist? You can't just ask, you know, well, you could ask the question, well, what would work better here? What would be practically useful? You might say, well, for these people, it might be more practically useful than to believe in God. But if you ask the ultimate question and say, what's the final nature of reality? Is there some self-existent being that depends on nothing whatsoever, but everything else depends on it? And you analyze, you don't find anything like that. And so then there's that category of thing, which is widely believed to be the case, which is discredited only by ultimate analysis, right? And that's the opposite, things that are, you know, the opposite of emptiness, some intrinsically real thing, right? So in that sense, you lopped off another piece of the pie. So in that sense, I've been left with a severely truncated pie. That subset of the things that people say, talk about, which are not subject to falsification, either by conventional empirical evidence or reasoning that's based on that empirical evidence at the conventional level or at the ultimate level. And those empirical evidence and the conventional analysis and ultimate analysis each lop off their sections of the pie, and then I'm left with this bit in the middle. So I was thinking about, and that is my way of explaining what Tsongkhapa says in the Great Treatise. It's a lopping off process. And it's like, one of the things I thought is, like, well, it doesn't really explain where new stuff comes from. You know, it's like, you have to say, like, so I guess what I'm thinking about with this a little bit, and I'm saying that there's probably things that are not part of our world map right now that people aren't talking about there's no talk about, no one even imagines them. Let's put it that way. It's not just that we're not talking about them, that we can suppose that there are things, there are more things in heaven and earth that are dreamed of in our philosophy at this point. There's things that we don't know about, right? But that we could say, in a sense, exist conventionally. That is, that like, in the same sense that we were talking about yesterday, that, like, there doesn't have to be, like, somebody watching and weighing a pound of butter all the time for it to be an amount of butter that is suitable when weighed on Earth at one gravity to come out at 1 pound. And like that, there's things like, so there's a part of the Amazon maybe where people haven't gone. It doesn't mean that there's nothing there until people go in and look. It's like, there thing, maybe there's a root in there that will, you know, help people with Lou Gehrig's disease that, like, is there right now and is suitable for that. but people haven't actually like imagined it yet. So I'm trying to say that this is not like an idealist system. In this system, there are external objects. There are external objects that, in my way of understanding, and then this is my way of interpreting it, they're not only external objects, but they're external objects that are not necessarily held in view at each moment and posited as existing as that in each moment by a living being. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like they're suitable to be posited as that by the unimpaired faculties of a certain kind of being, but they might also be suitable to be posited as something else by the unimpaired faculties of another being. They don't have any existence as a certain such and such a thing in and of themselves from their own side. But nonetheless, they can be suitable to be a cure for Lou Gehrig's disease from the point of view of humans, right? The ants, you know, it wouldn't be like that for them. Do you know what I'm saying? So it's not like they have some intrinsic nature as that, but they do exist externally such that for us, it would be suitable to find them and discover them as that. And that's my way of positing this, that there's, that we can say that there are external objects, some of which are perhaps suitable to be observed as X, where X is something we have not yet imagined, but are not yet seen. That's what I'm going to say. And I would tell you also that not everybody, even in Gelugpa, interprets it this way. But on the other hand, I don't think I'm completely making this up. I feel like this way of explaining it is consistent with teachings of Kensur Yeshe Tupten in the book The Path to the Middle, and also by my teacher, Geshe Peldon Takpa. But they're, like, if you look in, say, many other books, like, you'll find that by Gelugpa teachers, you will find different explanations, not just exactly matching what I've said about what it means for things to be conventionally existent or posited by the mind. But that's my way of saying it. So, let's see how we're doing.
Rolling along. Right? We're supposed to go to 10:30, aren't we? Diana is the timekeeper.
Keep going.
We started at 10:30.
Oh, we're supposed to go to 11:30. Yeah,
so you have
7. Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to know. I wasn't saying I have too much or too little. I was like, orient myself. So we've been positing here that there is such thing as reliable empirical evidence and possibility of knowing things at the conventional level, even though our senses are in some sense deceived. One of the problems that in the Great Treatise, and I address in Introduction to Emptiness, that Tsongkhapa deals with in this regard, is that both the Samadhi Raja Sutra, the King of Concentration Sutra that we cited yesterday, and Chandrakirti seem very clearly to say that the senses are not reliable in any way. And people, other Tibetans before Tsongkhapa who read that said, well, that's pretty clear. You know, we can't, these senses are all, you know, part of the structure of ignorance and we can't rely on them, right? But, you know, Tsongkhapa had been told by Manjushri that Chandrakirti was reliable, so he's not going to go outside of Chandrakirti. So he looks carefully exactly what Chandrakirti says and he quotes it, and it's very convincing. That if you read these passages carefully in context, you understand that Chandrakirti is not saying that you can't count on your senses to tell red from blue. He's not saying that. He's saying that when it comes to how things really exist, when it comes to knowing whether things are empty or not, you cannot in any way, shape, or form count on your senses. That's what he's saying. He's saying they're not going to be reliable about whether, you know, Josh is objectively established with Joshua-ness over there or not. I can't count on him for that because, you know, but that doesn't mean that, in fact, Chandrakirti later says that for the world, there are, you know, reliable sources of knowledge. So when he says for the world, there are reliable sources of knowledge, but they're not, but then the senses aren't reliable anyway, in any way, how do you want to put that together? Well, before Tsongkhapa, the way people put it together is like those stupid people in the world have this whack idea that they can like count on these senses, but it's clear that they're completely wrong, and that's what we learn from Buddhism. And basically, they're, you know, so we have to like get out of this world where we have no reliable information And it's like, this is always like unclear to me. Well, how do you get from here to there? It's like, so you have to have some, pole vaulting I'm using today. It's like, leap over is actually a term that's used, some sort of ladder, like chutes and ladders, to have bypass system, for getting out of the mire. And, maybe that will depend upon a higher power or something will come into play, or we'll get some sort of leverage to get out, because we don't have any kind of evidence that we can work with, that we can count on. But Tsongkhapa says, like, no, that's not right. That's not the way to read it. When he says that in the world there are these reliable sources of information, he means that conventionally we have reliable information, even though this information cannot be reliable about the final mode of existence. In other words, it's reliable for all kinds of things except the question of what is this really? And that's, if you put it together like that, it seems very clear. I can tell that this is a table and not a cat, even though it's at the same time appearing to me as a table that's not dependent on, it doesn't seem to be dependent on its causes and conditions. It doesn't appears to be solid and unitary or objectively established, that not depending on its parts, not depending on us agreeing to like designate it a table. It just appears to be naturally set up as a table from its own side. And that's like, that kind of appearance is faulty and deceptive and pervasive throughout cyclic existence, from the beginning of the path until the instant before you become a Buddha. You're always being plagued except for the moments when you're in directly realizing emptiness, by this kind of false appearance. But it doesn't mean that it's wrong about that. It doesn't mean it's wrong about everything. I mean, it's like, when you stop to think about it, it seems so simple. Just because something is completely unreliable, somebody can be like, it's like that with people. Like, you can make sense of the reliable people and unreliable people. But then you can say, oh, this person's always unreliable when they're talking about certain kinds of things, and can be counted on when they're talking about other kinds of things because of how their afflictions are operating, right? Oh, we could understand it like that. Or here's another example. Suppose we have a person who's colorblind, but is in another way, impeccably honest and scrupulous observer, right? How would this person work for us as a witness in a traffic accident at an intersection, where the light's changing? What do you think?
You couldn't call on them.
Well, if you don't call them in at all, then you don't have any testimony that will help you convict the criminal responsible for the car crash of cyclic existence. this is a serious personal injury here, and we want to get to the root of the problem. And our only witness is completely colorblind, and they can't tell us whether the light, an impression they have about there was a green color or a red color is completely unreliable. Exactly. They know some stuff that's relevant to the question. And we can deduce from what they do know other things about the color of the light, even though they can't be counted on about the color of the light. Right? Mm-hmm. Oh, there it is. That's how you do it. It's all very clear. I love that example. I mean, that's exactly what it is. Our senses are constantly telling us that things have a certain kind of existence, but they're also giving us at the same time reliable information, which is the only starting point we have for reasoning our way towards understanding that very appearance is deceptive. I mean, where else are we going to get the evidence? You can say, oh, well, Buddha said things are empty, so I'll believe in it. But right, but that's like not the same as knowing it or experiencing it. You're not going to get very far just on that faith, right? To know that things are empty, you have to have some evidence to work with. That evidence has to come from those same ontologically colorblind senses. Right? That's how it works. Okay. Now we will. It seems like we just started to me. I'm going by the schedule, though. I see the clock. It's been 1 hour.
I guess we better take a break, huh?
Let's take a break.
We also have, during this break, we have a video. So we're trying to be, for the people who didn't see the video of His Holiness teaching related topics to this weekend's discussion, then Tom and Natalie have put together some clips of His Holiness's teaching at Lehigh University in 2008 that kind of illustrate that. And where were you going to show it? You're going to set it up upstairs.
You don't want to just have people go down? Because I'm just feeling, because it was sprinkling, I don't know if you went.
Excuse me?
It was sprinkling, so then I was nervous about the water.
Don't have to be nervous.
Okay, so but that won't be until 12:45.
Yeah, right? Right after lunch.
Right after lunch. Now we're taking a break for preparing and having lunch.
Hi.
Thank you.
Yeah, everybody. Yeah.
Well, we'll be back later.
Okay, so as far as the schedule goes, for everybody who's on Skype, better be accurate. Yeah.
So yeah, we're sticking to the schedule, right?
Yeah, we're sticking to.